Hey there, everybody. You are listening to This Show Is So Gay. I'm your host, Ken Schneck. This is episode number 414. As always, you can get in touch with us by dropping us a line, send an email on over to ken@thisshowisogay.com, stroll on over to thisshowisogay.com to learn all about the fun things happening with our little gay radio show that could. You can follow us on Twitter, the handle is This Show Is So Gay, and of course, go on over to that Facebook, type in This Show Is So Gay, like us, because we sure as heck like you. We have an incredible show for you all this week. We must get started. Let me introduce our guest to you. Maren Johns is an editor, a teacher, a writer, and oh so much more. From 2001 to 2009, she served as editor of LOTL Magazine, Australia's leading lesbian journal of record. She was then the editor-in-chief of Bound Magazine, an international queer women's lifestyle magazine. And for the past 7 years, she has served as the editor-in-chief of Curve Magazine, widely and rightly considered to be the lesbian publication out there. Maren is an award-winning journalist and is a regular speaker and panelist at national and international events on the topics of lesbian culture, media, travel, and so many more topics. But right this very second, she is here with us. Maren, welcome to This Show Is So Gay.
My goodness, thank you for having me, Ken. It's lovely to be here.
We have so much ground to cover. Maren, are you ready?
I'm ready.
When little Maren Johns was skipping around Australia, was this the dream? Did she want to be in publishing?
Oh, you know, all I can say is that I used to read a lot of magazines and I really took what I read in them seriously. And I used to like loiter with intent around newsstands back in Sydney and, you know, just stare at the covers, you know, Vanity Fair and Vogue and wonder what was going on. And when I realized I was a baby dyke, of course, I was hunting down The Advocate and whatever else I could find. But I really respond to magazines because they seem to me to be possibilities and open doors to the universe of, you know, news and fashion and food and culture and celebrity lifestyle, which was always fascinating to me. So maybe when I was young, I didn't kind of target journalism or publishing. I came in the back door, really. But magazines have always been a constant in my life, yes.
What was that point where you knew, oh, wait a second, I can totally make a career out of this?
I think when I didn't get tenure as an academic,
yeah.
And I'd spent 7 years writing a PhD that was 120,000 words and only three people read it. And as a sideline and a kind of hobby, I'd been freelance writing for gay male editors that I knew and through friends of mine who hooked me up. And here was some of my reviews getting published and there were 100,000 people reading them. And I found a community there and I thought, why don't I just, I mean, and I loved academia, I love teaching and I love all of that, but it moves very slowly. And this was around, you know, the late 90s and the internet was starting to happen. And I think I saw pretty quickly which way it was going to go for me. And that was not to be locked up in the ivory tower, spending 10 years writing one thing that three people would read.
You know, I don't think I've ever been so depressed in the past 10 years about how few people have read my dissertation until you just phrased it that way.
Because you're a fellow academic. So, and I say everything I just said, I say with absolute love and fondness. And I still think in a parallel universe, I have Professor Maren out there teaching, you know, film studies and performance art and all of that, you know, the things I used to teach. And I hope she's gone on and written books and done wonderful things.
Oh, let's be clear. I want out. I'm using this as using this interview as a job interview for Curve. So I'm there with you. Trust me. Trust me. We are good.
Well, Ken, I'm happy to share with you that we are an equal opportunity employer, and I even have straight men who write for us. So, you know, we have all sorts of people who come through the Curve doors, and, you know, they're gay, straight, genderqueer, bisexual, transgender, and even those heteros.
They seem like nice people. I met one back in 88. There's nice people, those heteros. But I would imagine doing the work that you have done for so long, you have to be aware of stereotypes that exist with gay and lesbian media, correct?
Oh, yeah. And also for the girls, I can say that lesbians have had a very hard road to publishing. And, you know, just being women makes it more difficult to get published because we are less resourced than men. And I feel very thankful that I had gay men who, you know, were more powerful than me and better situated than me that actually said, come on in and write for me and show me what you can do. And they really were my mentors. So I do have a kind of kinship with them. But I will say that women do struggle to get their work out there. They do get paid less. the readership is more, I'd say, resistant. I think gay men are more supportive of their titles. And that's one of the stereotypes in publishing that I really want to dispel. I really want to try and wake our readership up and say, look, you know, we're family. Come on, support us. Or when you log on, you know, next year, when you've broken up with your wife and your cats run away, we might not be here. of course, we will be, but that's a message I want to send out, a solidarity to all of the girls. We need lesbian publishing, and that's a real mission of mine.
Are there differences doing this work in Australia as opposed to doing it in the US?
Not so much in the actual mechanics of publishing. I think that the whole world is going through a publishing crisis in the sense of what we read and how we read has really changed rapidly in the last decade. But in terms of culture, yes, it is very different. And when I first started editing in the US, I had to pull my horns in, I have to tell you, because otherwise every issue of the magazine would be wrapped in plastic.
Right.
Because back in Australia, we are a lot more carefree about sex and sexual imagery. We're a lot more European in what we can say. We have this abrasive sense of humour that we don't think is going to be taken too seriously. It's that ironic British colonial sense of humour. And you couldn't get away with that here. You'd be, you know, in big trouble. So
right.
I really had to become a more orthodox voice and kind of Americanize myself and really understand the seriousness of the gay rights movement and the struggle here. And it's funny to see now, looking back in Australia, we don't have gay marriage, we don't have marriage equality in Australia, and I'm seeing a rights movement really start to take off there, and people are getting quite passionate about equal rights in Australia, as of course America's been through that. We've had that a 20-year history trying to win marriage equality. Thank God we did.
It's so funny that you say wrapped in plastic. I haven't even told anybody this. Someone gifted me, and by the way, whoever did this, thank you. Someone gifted me a subscription to Out Magazine last month. And because it wasn't something that I ordered myself, I've certainly had subscriptions in the past, I wasn't able to check off the box that said, I don't need it wrapped in white plastic. So it was so funny to go to my mailbox and pull this out. And of course, my housemate figured, okay, you just ordered porn. But it was a nice reminder that's right. I have all of these privileges where I live my life as an out gay male and as an out member of this community. And my brothers and sisters, there's so many that don't have that privilege and need that to be wrapped in the white plastic.
Yes. And I look, in a way, we're damned if we don't, and then we're damned if we do, because if we do wrap it in plastic, a lot of readers do take offense. What's wrong? What are you telling me about my sexuality? What's wrong? And then, you know, however, a good percentage of our readers live in the southern states or the Midwest, where they can absolutely be fired from their job if that information comes out. So, yeah, it should be a personal choice in terms of how out you feel you can be with your reading material, and there should be no judgment attached to that.
Yeah. I have to ask you my favorite question that I have posed to your colleagues over at The Advocate and over at Out Magazine. How do we figure out, Marin, the ratio of straight people versus gay people on the covers of our magazines?
Ooh, that's a really good question, because, you know, a cover image is loaded,
yeah,
and it has a kind of symbolic value. And I don't think putting a straight person on the cover of a gay magazine is necessarily a bad thing, especially if that person is a known ally to the community or if they're an actor who's played gay many times. I think the job of the editor is somehow, on a gut level, you just have to know when enough is enough, not enough is not enough, and too much is too much. And I myself have I have 6 print issues a year, and I try and make as much variety within those 6 as I can. So we definitely need a woman of color. If we're going to have a white young woman on one issue, we should choose a slightly older person who's possibly a woman of color on the next issue, and so forth. I do like to alternate it so that people don't feel they're getting a kind of monoculture through the magazine. I think the magazine needs to reflect honestly how diverse our readership is, and that includes straight people. So we only have a few straight readers, I think, but symbolically there are people who are straight that we value greatly.
Right.
I can't think of anyone right now, but no.
They're out there.
So maybe they're out there. No, seriously, probably one, I'd like to say one cover out of 6 I could put a straight person on, possibly.
I would love to talk about your role. So you have this role as editor-in-chief. And by the way, I look at all the different bullet points that are associated with editor-in-chief, and I feel overwhelmed. So just on a day-to-day basis, how do you go about managing your time?
I don't. I think it's awful. And I think my publisher probably gets frustrated because she sees me working sometimes 12, 16-hour days. It depends if you're in production, which right. is the moment that you pass deadline and you start to assemble a magazine and your goal is to get it to the printers on time. That moment, time goes out the window. We just are working until we get it done. And then there's a frenzied, you know, a few days when you go into the shipping, what we call ship or shipping the magazine. And that's when you just, you know, crossing the T's, dotting the I's, looking for mistakes, making sure all the photo credits are there, making sure, you know, whatever you put on the cover, something didn't happen out in the world that has completely invalidated that as a choice, you know. So there's a lot of stress and time management. It is important, but honestly, I think any editor who works in print will tell you that you just have to keep doing it until it's done. And you can send it to the printers. And even then, it's not over, Ken. Even then the printer calls you and says, hey, you've got a low-res image on page 68. You've got to do, you know, or something happens always. But, yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons print is terrible, because it's such a time suck. You know, it takes so much extra time to sit there fixing layouts and meeting all those standards you need to meet for pre-press. And then there's that weird time lag where you put the magazine to bed, it's gone to the printers, you can't touch it, but it doesn't come out for 2 more weeks.
Right.
So you just hope to God that nothing happens in the real world that's going to, you know, make your choices questionable.
I accept that. Having done this show now for almost 10 years, I accept that a story is going to break as soon as I post this podcast. It took me a very long time to accept that.
Yeah. I mean, I think, funnily enough, it's not just us in publishing that understand this now. It's everybody who's connected to social media and digital media. And that's ordinary people. Anyone with a Facebook account knows that when they log on to their Facebook account, they see what's trending in that right-hand margin, and that literally the world can be a different place than they left it the night before, and they wake up and something else has blown up. And so this concept of breaking news, which was really just a once upon a time a kind of an industry thing, is now a global thing. Everybody understands it. And the different factor here is viral, what gets shared so rapidly that you can't stop, and you're not even sure it's true when you hear it.
Right.
Which is, that's the difficult part.
Let me read you a sentence that I think you are quite aware of. The sentence reads this: to maintain and build upon 25 years of successful publishing and continue to offer fresh and diverse content for lesbian and bisexual women through quality journalism and community involvement. That, of course, being the mission statement there at Curve Magazine. How do you go about putting your imprint, Marin's imprint, on that mission statement?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? What does an editor-in-chief do?
Right.
And why that person? I mean, why, when we think, let's just take somebody random like Anna Wintour, why her? And why does everybody want her view of what fashion is? And almost like, how dare she know? Like, why is there one person who can select content and say, this is what you're looking at this month and not something else? And I think it's a strange position to be in, but it's one you need to look at with responsibility and a great deal of humility. And what I try to put into the magazine that is myself is often a lot of voices that we wouldn't ordinarily hear from. So people who are coming up or people that are doing something interesting, and they need a little bit of the spotlight. So I've never been one of these people who, as much as I love celebrity culture and especially celebrity culture from my generation coming up in the 90s, which was really interesting, an interesting time, I think celebrities can also be quite boring in the sense that what they're putting out into the universe is what they want to put out. They just media as a kind of promotional tool for themselves. And meanwhile, I mean, and that sometimes can be wonderful if we like what they're doing and if it reflects well on us or if it has a message there for us. But often there's other people who are really, really more fascinating, and especially women, gay women and queer women and genderqueer women are doing fascinating things, and they might not be people that you've heard of, but you should. So that's something I really try and bring to the magazine. And something else is really, I've tried to up the ratio of women of colour in the magazine because I felt that curve was a little bit too white before. And I'm just a white woman from Australia, from a British colony. But I think coming in as an outsider, I mean, I live in New York, and when I get on the subway to go anywhere, I'm a minority in the city, and I'm a minority in many places in this country. And I think that I wanted the magazine not to be a white space anymore, but to really reflect the diversity that I saw around me every day. And I think that's something that we have achieved. Just so things like that, they might not necessarily be me, my personal life, my personal obsessions. I think that's too indulgent to run a magazine that way. It's just more, I mean, I'm a Libra, so that's really, not to get all astrological on you, but in a way I'm always looking for balance, and I'm always, you know, if I come into your apartment, the first thing I'll probably say is, why is that cushion there? Now, if you put that cushion over there, maybe you'll have something. So I'm always liking to arrange things and kind of like fluff up the cushions and make sure that you have complementary colors and all sorts of things.
Yeah. Again, listeners, we are here with Maren Johns, editor-in-chief of Curve Magazine. You have seen, we have all seen print publications come and go over the years. Not to put you on the spot and do a state of the media address, but in terms of the state of print publications, particularly within the LGBTQ media, what contributes to a publication staying in place right now and being successful? I would imagine it's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. Moving with the times is really, really critical. I mean, when I came on board at Curve, we barely had a functioning website. We had no social media presence. I've not done this all on my own. We've had a team of, you know, dedicated people that have often been just interns or fellow travelers or well-wishers or me and my publisher working crazy hours to get something happening. It's really just about trying to be responsive and really listening to what people want. So we, you know, we launched a digital version of the magazine, a website, social media network for the magazine, and we've got some very, very high figures now for the type of publication that we are. And that's just taken some sensitivity, I think, in trying to anticipate what lesbians and queer women want today. And social media is such a distraction, and it, in many ways, can be quite, I think, a negative force in people's lives. But it can also be a positive thing, and it can be the community that women have always struggled to find. And a lot of lesbians live in, you know, in poverty and isolation, and, you know, the town they live in doesn't have a gay bar, or it doesn't have a women's centre or an LGBT centre. But, you know, if you log on to Curve's Facebook wall, suddenly you've got 100 lesbians on that one post, and you can see other women. So that's been something that we've done quite wholeheartedly, I think, is try to revive this idea of what we used to call back in the day, the lesbian grapevine, that sense of community that we knew was somewhere out there. You just had to find it.
One of the hallmarks of Curve Magazine, having followed you guys for just so long, and one of the things I appreciate so much about the work that you all are doing, is that Curve is distinctly intergenerational. It feels like you are putting content out there to appeal to not just this target demographic, but as many different generations of queer women out there as possible. That feels very intentional to the reader.
I'm glad. I mean, it is intentional because we do often hear from older lesbians that they feel that there's not much for them out there, and I suspect that's true. And there's always been a bit of a, I guess you have it in the gay male community too, that feeling that there were generations, you know, going back to the Mattachine Society that were doing all this activism for you back in the 50s. They were really laying the groundwork, and then when they're really old and aging out, and you've got the young kids come along, they don't really know, they don't want to know, they're like, who's that grumpy old person, you know, why don't they like us? And I feel I really wanted to kind of bridge some of those gaps between generations and definitely sew into the magazine different ages and voices and images. And I don't think I'm doing it enough yet, but we're still working on it. And it is really important to us. So if anyone out there over the age of 50 who is hearing this and thinks they have a story or know somebody who has a story, please put them in touch with me.
You got it. You got it. Well, let's talk about a couple of your own passions, because here's some things I know about you. One passion of yours, Maren Johns, she enjoys the travel.
I do, but you know what's funny? I never did really. And I know that's somehow like my brand now, but I think it's also strategic for me, because I think you can be very desk-bound as an editor, and you can be quite isolated. And I love New York, but honestly, I could be chained to my desk 24/7 and never move.
Right.
And then almost by accident, I found this interesting LGBT travel community in which we were able to move around the world and go to key pride events and different kind of things on the international gay calendar that meant that not only could I meet real people, real international activists doing things, but I could also say, hey, you know, Curve, there's this magazine called Curve and we exist and you know, how can we help each other? So yeah, it's not, I'm not a selfie person. You'll never see, well, I hope you'll never see me by the side of the pool plumping up my lips, you know, with a filter. I'm just not, you'll never see me wearing dog ears. You'll never see me with, I'm not one of those people. I'm not an Instagrammer. But I do like traveling because for me it's like gosh, it refreshes my perspective and it really educates me. And I think I'm a lifelong student. I think I am. You know, I think I just want to keep learning.
Yeah. I want to remind our listeners that we do have a promotion running right now that if you have a picture of Maren Johns doing pouty lips by a pool, you get a free This Show Is So Gay magnet. Just want to put that out there. What's one of those places that's not on our radar that should be on our radar to visit?
Oh, gosh, that's a tough one. I mean, I love, gosh.
Your pictures of India were incredible.
Oh, and that was a trip of a lifetime. And yeah. I was a little bit scared to go because I just, you know, women are not treated that well in India. And there have been horrible incidents there, you know, rapes and murders and such. And I really do have conflicting feelings about that continent, just as I do about Africa. But you can't generalize. And you need to know that there are really powerful matriarchal and LGBT-friendly communities in those places. And yes, India is a transformation. And that really did wake me up, that trip. I met the gay prince of India, and I met lots of LGBT people, and it was really fantastic. I'm also a big fan of Scandinavia because they are, gosh, in so many ways, like Sweden is one of my favorite places, and I've been several times, and not just because one of my idols, Greta Garbo, is from Sweden,
yes.
But so many wonderful people have come from Sweden, and so many strong women, and they consistently try to be better as a country when it comes to all humans' rights, immigrant rights, women's rights, and LGBTQ rights. It's like a mandate for that country, and I really, really love them for it. There's plenty of places. I'll tell you what, it was really interesting to go to Argentina and Patagonia and to meet queer women down there,
yeah.
Because you feel it's so far-flung, and that just goes to show that there are gay, there's like little pockets of gayness all over the world.
They're everywhere. They're everywhere. And you dovetailed right into another passion that I know you have, and that's some of the stars of the silver screen. Why should our listeners, why should, particularly when we're talking about intergenerational work, and maybe our younger listeners and your younger readers just don't have a great appreciation for Bette Davis and Katharine Hepburn, and you've done such incredible writing about them in Vanity Fair. Why should we know about these silver screen stars?
Oh, gosh. First and foremost, their strength. You know, movie stars today have nothing on these women, what these women had to do. I mean, working in Hollywood studios back then was more like working in a sweatshop than anything glamorous. And yet, after all of the long hours, you know, often they were making two movies, three movies a year back to back and such. On top of that, they had to deal with horrible, the inequity of gender relations back then, and also uphold an image of glamour while they're doing it. And people forget that, you know, Bette Davis changed union rules for women in America, and Katharine Hepburn changed dress code for women in America, and Greta Garbo as well, and people like Dietrich, who I'm a fan of. It's just we can get very down in the mouth these days about our minority identities and feel very sad for ourselves and always bemoan what we don't have. But what I love about history, especially the history of the performing arts and cinema, is I can take you back and show you women that actually did something for themselves then, and those images live on forever. They're there. You can just look them up and use them as inspiration.
Love it. Absolutely love it. What should we be looking forward to with the next issue of Curve magazine?
Oh, I am actually working on one issue now that'll be out in a few weeks. You know, it's always always interesting. The mix is usually slightly themed. We will probably have a celebrity cover, but we will have a really great section on sporting heroes and sheroes, actually. And they might not be the women you expect to read about. They might just be somebody a little bit different. We've got a beautiful in-depth feature on a disability and queer women who are disabled and doing amazing things, whether that's in modelling or activism or sport. And that article has really been heartwarming to work on, and it's really another example of the kind of visibility that I think we do really well in Curve. It's a story that needs to be told. But always, I mean, just go into Barnes & Noble and have a look and see if you like what's in there. And if not, just friend us on Facebook, because like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram, and you'll get a taste of what we're doing each issue and what we do each day. The website is updated each day with new, fresh content and great vloggers and people you can follow and have a lot of fun. I think we've got a sense of humor at Curve.
I give you the floor. I love giving our colleagues in this work the floor to extol. I know you are not the only one doing this work at Curve Magazine. I give you the floor to extol the virtues of all those great people that you get to work with at Curve Magazine.
Well, we so many. I mean, I can't even tell you how many women I've worked with over the last 7 years, including the previous administration, the previous publisher who founded the magazine, Franco Stevens, out of San Francisco back in the 90s, and the long-serving editor-in-chief under her tenure, Diane Anderson Minchell, who really created this magazine. Yeah. It's not something that I created, I have to be honest. I've really only been the steward of the magazine for the last 7 years with the new publisher, Silke Bader. And I think we've been well placed to get the magazine into the next phase of publishing. That's really been the challenge, is that it couldn't really stay in the mode it was before, and it had to change. And we've had a lot of women help us, and I think they know who they are. But many, many women, and the readers, really, it's really important that the readers come with us, otherwise we don't have a magazine.
There it is. We'll end with a little bit of passion. Tell our listeners how this work feeds you. You've stayed engaged in this work for so long. It's this particular subset of the media that we put out there, and you do it so well. How does it feed you? What keeps you going?
What keeps me going is always something new and knowing that I've made a difference to somebody. Nice. And that if I wasn't doing this, I'm not quite sure who would be.
Yeah.
There probably would be somebody doing it. But the fact that it's being done makes me happy, because I know it's making other people happy.
There it is. Listeners, this is what we need you to do. You can stroll on over to Curve Mag. That's curvemag.com. You can get a subscription there. You can certainly access content online. Just incredible work. I have been following you for so long. I joked with you off the air that I don't really understand why it's taken us this long to get you on the show, because I certainly appreciate everything that you're putting out there. And you surely know that you are giving just countless women, men, members of the LGBTQ community out there a sense of community that they absolutely would not have if not for Curve Magazine, if not for the pieces that you guys put out there to the world. You truly create community, and it is enormously appreciated.
Well, thank you, Ken.
CurveMag.com. Marin, please keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you so much. And this show was so gay.
Mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and here today. Picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality.
All right, folks, and we are back. Well, we actually have tons of time left on this week's episode, so let's get to all of the latest LGBTQ news that's out there. If you are not talking about Charlottesville, heck, I do not know why you're not talking about Charlottesville, because we all need to be talking about Charlottesville. First of all, this absolutely is an LGBTQ story. If you don't think it is, you are absolutely wrong. There were protesters in Charlottesville who were chanting F you and then the F word that very negatively describes gay people, and those were alt-right, those were Nazis, those were white nationalists, and they were chanting it over and over and over again at their Unite the Right march. And so still people using the F word in that way, and again, not just the curse word, the F you word, but also the F word that describes gay people as negatively as possible. One of the most violent anti-gay words out there, and it was being used constantly all throughout. But to hear the president's remarks, the president of the United States, right? And I don't have to flash back that far to Dana Goldberg on last week's episode. And it was such a thrill to have her on the show and talk about politics and in a most entertaining way, in the way that she does. But she stumbles every time she has to say President Trump. And it's comical. And then you have things like this where we stumble over saying President Trump because it is awe-inspiring. It is awe-inspiring that the president of the United States would stand up in front of a bank of microphones and make the argument that the alt-right, right, these Nazis, these white supremacists, these white nationalists who are out there are somehow equivalent to people on the left who went to protest them, the anti-protesters. And he stood up there and he made those statements, and that within those Nazi groups and those, and you have to just keep saying it over and over, those white nationalist groups, that there were fine people. That's a quote, fine people there, right? Even Jimmy Kimmel stood up in one of his opening monologues on his show this week and said, yeah, if you're standing next to someone who is saying these horrible, horrible things and you're not immediately leaving that group, you are not a fine person. There were not fine people marching, right? And this affects us on so many different levels. There certainly were anti-gay things happening, but maybe you're thinking, okay, that was kind of isolated, the anti-gay piece, and this is more about race. Yeah, all the more reason that we need to show up. I have said over and over again on this show over the years, and again, we're coming up on 10 years talking about this right now, we could be doing such a better job, and I could be doing such a better job of talking about that intersection between sexual orientation and race. Right? It's a tricky intersection to talk about. It's always tricky to find guests because it requires that people be open about their sexual orientation. That's just LGBTQ guests. And then on the other side, we have all of the homophobia that exists in many communities of color. And so finding guests of color, LGBTQ guests of color, can sometimes be a challenge. And we hear from incredible change agents and thought leaders and all these just incredible people we've had on the show over the years about their work doing this work, doing equality work, raising up voices at that intersection of race and sexual orientation, all the challenges that they have faced, both racism and homophobia, and certainly misogyny for our female counterparts, right? So difficult, this work, and yet they are raising up their voices. But for those of us who aren't fully embracing that work, we have to be. Even if there isn't an explicit LGBTQ angle, why aren't we showing up more, right? What would it mean if we showed up more? Because when something anti-gay happens, we certainly stand up and say, well, where is everybody? Why isn't everybody standing next to us? Where is everybody? We need everybody banding together with us. Well, have we done that for everybody else? Equality is equality. It's not just about LGBTQ equality. It's about us standing up for others and using our voice the way we know how to use it when our brothers and sisters, even if they are not LGBTQ, are being oppressed. And that's happening every single day with regards to race. And then something happens to us and we look around and say, well, where is everybody? Well, I don't know that we did our part to stand up for everybody else. And we have issues of racism within the LGBTQ community. We talk about this all the time. We have stuff that we need to address. When we look at the executive directors of all of our major LGBTQ organizations, they're all white. They are. Just do your research. They're all white, with very few exceptions. So we have work to do. I just get so annoyed when something anti-LGBTQ happens and people are on Facebook, on social media, decrying, well, why are we standing by ourselves? Because we didn't show up for other people. I've told this story before, I'll tell it again. Here in Cleveland last summer, in the summer of 2016, they were passing an ordinance that finally updated some regulations here in Cleveland to be trans inclusive. And our colleagues had been working on this for years. Truly, Equality Ohio, a lot of different organizations had been working with public officials here for years to update these ordinances to be more trans inclusive. Well, on the day that our city council was voting on this, it was the same day that they were also, the city council was considering some proposals to increase the minimum wage. So right here in Cleveland, I was there. I was absolutely there. You had all of the gay folks who had been working on this for years, sitting outside all of the folks who had been working on increasing the minimum wage, which predominantly was a community of color. Predominantly activists of color and people who are change agents of color and people who have been working so tirelessly to increase the minimum wage and get to a place where, hello, we need a livable wage, right? So important. So first up on the agenda was the ordinance for making Cleveland more trans inclusive. And it passed and everybody cheered. And then what happened? Myself included, basically all the gay people got up and left the room. We didn't show up for our brothers and sisters of color who were fighting for their issue. And you can sure as heck bet that they were applauding for our group when these ordinances became more trans inclusive. It was a great example. And let me just speak from the eye on that one, right? We gave up our seats and there were more seats for more people and all of these different excuses. Why did I leave, right? Sure, I had to go somewhere. I don't even remember at this point where I had to go. But it was a great example of, we have to show up for our brothers and sisters of color. And what has happened in Charlottesville and decrying what the president of the United States stood at the bank of microphones and said, I mean, it was, my mouth dropped open. And it's difficult to be surprised by this president at this point and still to see him there saying, wow, there are fine people who are standing alongside Nazis. Standing alongside white supremacists and white nationalists. There were fine people there as they were saying horribly anti-Semitic, racist, homophobic things. No fine people there. Use your voice. You have to step up and say this is not acceptable. What happened in Charlottesville is not acceptable, and what the President of the United States said is not acceptable. And of course, our thoughts go out to the family and the friends of Heather Heyer, who was tragically murdered in the events of Charlottesville last weekend, as well as the two state troopers, two police officers who also lost their lives in connection to everything that happened in Charlottesville. I got to start class on Monday. I have to start class in just a few days and talk about race. And I certainly sat on my couch this past weekend and I was all kinds of choked up thinking, well, how the heck am I supposed to do this? Should I just not be doing this? But it's all the more reason that we have to be doing it. So that's a bit on Charlottesville. Let's talk about some other news out there. A man has been arraigned on a hate crime charge after allegedly sending homophobic death threats directly to law enforcement. Daniel Civera was arrested in New York City after sending an email to law enforcement officials that threatened to hunt down and murder gay police officers. This 26-year-old was held on hate crime charges of aggravated harassment over his online messages. Court documents state that on July 28th, Silvera had sent a threatening email to New York Police Department Detective Brian Downey, who is the president of Gay Officers Action League. The court heard that the email specifically named the Gay Officers Action League in the email, threatening to, quote, kill every gay and lesbian police officer with weapons. So stuff like that still happens, and we need to know that stuff like that happens. Perez Hilton, he very publicly broke down on camera after being fired from a dream job. The blogger and reality TV personality revealed that he had been let go from a dream job that he says would have changed his life. He refused to divulge what the role was, however, claiming he is too professional to share the details. In the emotional video, he declared, quote, "There is a reason this happened, and I'm sorry. I'm sorry again. I guess I have to say that more often. I'm sorry." And he kept crying, and we don't know what he was fired from. Prez Hilton is a really tricky beast, and it's something that I'm not calling him a tricky beast. I'm calling his situation a tricky beast. Anytime I see a news story about him, I'm not quite sure if I want to cover it or not. This is just kind of a silly one. I don't even know why I brought this one up, because he's crying on camera about a job that he lost, and we don't even know what the job is or why he lost it. So it's, I don't know about that. But I will say that, right, we should forgive people, and I need to work on forgiveness in my own life, and I know that, right? I'm very open about that. I just said it right here on the air on This Show Is So Gay. But, gosh, he perpetuated bullying for so long. He just did. He perpetuated bullying for so long, and he's been contrite about it, but he's just done such horrible things, and I know he was on Ellen apologizing for it, but I still am stuck with Perez Hilton just feeling, you know, not sure what to do with him. He appeared on the Celebrity Big Brother over there in Great Britain. He became one of the most notorious housemates of all time for his unpredictable moods. He was criticized for saying that living with Katie Hopkins, one of the other people living in the house, he said living with her was like living with the AIDS crisis, right? So he's just a problematic guy, and I don't know what job he got fired from, and I don't really know what his talents are, but he's got a lot of sway, and I wished he used it for positive reasons from the start, but I think one of the reasons that he has a lot of sway is because he was so controversial to begin with. So there's that. A multimillionaire tech company has pledged $300 million to support LGBTQ equality in America. Tim Gill of the Gill Foundation has said that he will punish the wicked. That's a quote, punish the wicked. And by that, he means those who oppose legislation which protects the LGBTQ community. The pledge comes as Gill is a staunch supporter of LGBT rights. He grew up in a Republican family and made his millions after selling software startup Quark. Remember Quark? For $500 million in 1992. Since then, he has continued to make fortunes as a programmer. He now has moved 60% of his assets into the Gill Foundation. The foundation was created to help fund the fight against the persecution of LGBTQ people. Gill said this quote, "It's the religious right that decided to make marriage an issue. They worked tirelessly on it for decades and they lost." One of his main focuses as an activist is defeating religious liberty legislation. In recent years, he fought a proposed Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Georgia, which he defeated through founding a protest group called Georgia Prospers. The group drafted an opposition petition, which drafted major businesses, including Coca-Cola, to oppose the bill, which was immediately vetoed. That's a great thing. Speaking about his activism, he said this quote, "When I look around the country, I see people that are victims of hate crimes, and he wants to make a difference." Kudos to Tim Gill, over $300 million pledged, and you can sure as heck bet that that is going to make a difference. Thank you, Tim Gill. A new study has found that more than half of parents in the U.S. would support their teenagers' request to transition. The study conducted by Harris on behalf of the American Osteopathic Association found that 53% of adults in the U.S. would support their kids' transition. Some have taken the study as a sign of growing acceptance. Of course it is. This is growing acceptance for trans people in the U.S. despite the Trump administration rolling back on trans protections. Speaking to PR Newswire, Dr. Laura Arrowsmith, who works at a trans clinic in Oklahoma, said, quote, "Parents have a significant role in raising transgender kids. Once they get on board, often after stages of denial, rejection, condemnation, and grief, they become powerful advocates at school and with extended family. This is crucial to the child's well-being." The study does note that trans young people and adults face higher rates of homelessness, HIV transmission, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and self-harm compared to the general population. But it is not because trans people, right, are more prone to homelessness, HIV transmission, depression, anxiety, substance abuse, and self-harm. That's not the reason. It links it. This study very directly links all of those horrible outcomes to the rejection of their families. It's connected to all of those things, right? So that we're at 53% of families who say, yes, I would support my teenager's transition. That will make a difference. That absolutely will make a difference. And it also makes the case for why, when you seek out resources, you should seek them out as a family. It's not just about the individual. If you have a 12-year-old to an 18-year-old transitioning, yeah, that's something that's going to affect the entire family. Don't just seek resources for that individual, for that child. The whole family should be having these conversations together, because that's actually what makes a difference. So, some encouraging results from that study. Now we have this story, and I've been kind of deep breathing through this because this just happened. The disgraced former judge who abused his authority, we just talked about this last week, right? I didn't think this is where this update was going to go, but here we are. The disgraced former judge who abused his authority to block gay weddings, he has now taken the lead in the race for the vacant U.S. Senate seat in Alabama. Roy Moore, the disgraced former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, he is running for the U.S. Senate seat vacated by President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions. Remember last week I said he was endorsed by Chuck Norris. I kind of was doing that as a joke story. And yes, now there will be a runoff between Roy Moore and another candidate because Roy Moore did that well. He did that well. He had the plurality. He did not have a majority or he would be the GOP candidate. But my gosh, he had the plurality of the votes there in Alabama. This is the most homophobic guy out there. He just is, right? And there's a lot of people alongside him. This is a guy who was suspended. He was suspended. He's not a judge anymore. He was absolutely suspended and disgraced as the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court because he stood up and said, the Supreme Court's decision on marriage equality does not apply here in Alabama, which first indicates that he's never taken a civics class, and I don't even understand how he ever passed the bar. I don't get that because that's not the way the law works here, sir. The Supreme Court, yeah, that overrides what's happening there in Alabama. And so he was kicked off. He was suspended from being a judge. And so I figured that made him a joke candidate. And then the endorsement of Chuck Norris only served to solidify that. Nope, not at all. He had the plurality of votes. And if he wins this runoff election, without question, President Trump is going to endorse him and promote his candidacy on Twitter. And that is not as directly homophobic as tweeting out, hey, trans people can't serve in the military anymore. But make no mistake about it, it is the utmost in homophobic. And President Trump will endorse him. He absolutely will. This is disgraced former Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, Roy Moore, outwardly and explicitly homophobic. And that does not disqualify you from winning the plurality of votes in the GOP election to get the main candidacy there, the GOP candidacy, to be a senator from the great state of Alabama. Not good. We're keeping our eyes on that. President Trump will endorse him. Can we have some happy news? An anti-trans bathroom bill has been killed off once more in Texas, and it's possible that the discriminatory legislation may now be on the back burner for good. Despite support from the Republican Governor Greg Abbott there in Texas, the special legislative session that he ordered ended in failure on several counts. After 29 of a planned 30 days, the House this week adjourned and ended the session. As well as the bathroom bill that would ban transgender people from using their preferred public bathroom, there were setbacks for plans on changes to property taxes and vouchers for private schools. There was a lot that they didn't get done. Sarah Kate Ellis, the president and CEO of GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation, said this quote, "Today's victory shows what can happen when transgender Americans and their allies stay vigilant and push back against legislation that helps no one and harms many." There you go. Joe D. Winterhoff of the Human Rights Campaign said this quote, "Finally, Texans can breathe a temporary sigh of relief. Texans don't want harmful anti-transgender legislation." Again, this special session cost so much money, and the governor there in Texas said, but this is a priority. But happily, and by the way, not just a priority, he said it was his top priority with everything else going on. He said that passing this draconian bill that would force trans people to use the bathroom of their, quote, biological sex, he said it was his top priority, despite everything else going on, not just in Texas, but in the U.S. This is his top priority. And they just wasted a flipping ton of money for this bill to fail, as it should have failed, and yay that it did fail, but give me a flippin' break that this is what they spent time and money on. More good news. Atari, the gaming system Atari, they have teamed up with the LGBT media organization to form a new inclusion strategy for their games. The company teamed up with LGBT Media, which created the LGBTQT app. The new deal aims to relaunch Pride Fest, which was announced in 2014, a city building simulator. Socially, the game will be expanding using LGBTQT. The two companies said they hope to set a new standard for gaming and to represent the LGBT community. Back in 2014, Atari announced the LGBT-themed game for iPhone and iPad, in which players organize a pride parade. The company, most known for its 1980s arcade hits, announced the release of Pride Fest, a LGBT-themed social sim game in which users play as the manager of a pride festival. In the game, players create their own pride parade. I love this. They create their own pride parade in a city of their choosing, allowing them to customize all the different floats in order to keep the city happy. I can't wait to play this. The company said at the time of the release, quote, players will need to solve challenges and complete quests to unlock new parade and festival supplies or receive other bonuses. The game will incorporate various personalization and social features, including the opportunity to chat with friends, visit each other's city, and create avatars bedecked in clothes and jewelry. You will soon be able to play Pride Fest, an LGBT-themed social sim game in which you can create your own pride festival. How freaking cool is that? I love that. Very cool. In the great state of Louisiana, the Louisiana governor is fighting at appeal to have an executive order protecting LGBT people in state government reinstated. Back in December, a judge ruled that Governor John Bel Edwards overstepped his authority by issuing an executive order to protect LGBTQ people. According to State District Judge Todd Hernandez, those opposed to the move said Edwards attempted to change the state constitution. This judge ruled that the order was unconstitutional as it attempted to create or expand state law. Governor Edwards' order banned discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity, while a three-judge panel of an appeal court this week heard arguments in the case, but the panel did not immediately issue a decision. Matthew Block, a lawyer for Edwards, said that the judge, quote, just got it wrong when he ruled in December. The executive order is not law, this lawyer, Matthew Block, said. It is internal policy to the executive branch about employment and about contracting standards. So we have to keep our eyes on that story in Louisiana, but kudos to Governor John Bel Edwards, who is trying to use his office as he should to create more equality within the bounds of his power. A little bit, going back a little bit to some Charlottesville news, a Fox News pundit has claimed that the LGBT pride flag represents the, quote, exact same thing as the Confederate flag. No. There's been a concerted effort in recent years to remove old Confederate monuments in the U.S., with the Confederate flag seen as a racist symbol due to its connection with slavery. But shockingly, one Fox News guest apparently doesn't see any difference between that and an LGBT flag. Appearing on Fox and Friends this week, conservative pundit Star Parker from the Center for Urban Renewal and Education suggested that the two flags are, quote, the same thing. She said this, quote, what's really interesting, with an incredible irony here, is that the same people that are demanding that the Confederate flag comes down are the same people that are insisting that the rainbow flag goes up. These two flags represent the exact same thing, that certain people groups are not welcome here. What on earth are you talking about? No, folks, I don't know if you need me to boil this down for you, but FYI, the rainbow flag and the Confederate flag, two different things. One takes pride in an identity that tries to create equality of an oppressed people. The other one is one that takes pride in oppressing other people. They are not the same thing. My Lord. some of the stuff that happens. Hey, a new campaign hopes to save a Rainbow Pride lifeguard tower from being erased. The tower, funded by Venice Pride in California, was erected earlier this year, but it will be, quote, erased on the 8th of September, and some people have set out to save it and make the installation permanent. Colin Campbell started a change.org petition to save the tower, which has been signed nearly 10,000 times. It urges the County Board of Supervisors to save the tower from being removed. Very exciting. The petition reads this, quote, located at Brooks Ave on Bill Rosendahl Memorial Beach in Venice, California, the Venice Pride Flag Lifeguard Tower has become a beloved destination for locals and tourists alike. In 9 weeks, thousands have flocked to photograph the dramatic tower and broadcast its powerful message of equality and inclusion to millions of people across the globe. On September 8th, the rainbow-colored tower is set to be erased forever. At a time when so much of what the LGBT community and its allies fought for is under attack, the LA County Board of Supervisors should save the Venice Pride Flag Lifeguard Tower by designating it a permanent public art project. Funded by Venice Pride, a local nonprofit dedicated to saving LGBTQ lives, and Dunn Edwards Paints, the tower serves as an important visual reminder that Los Angeles will always welcome people no matter whether they are gay, straight, lesbian, bi, transgender, queer, or questioning. This is such a great example of how people are using their voice to make a difference, right? Is this about legislation? No. Is this about trans people in the military? No. It's about a lifeguard tower. But it's a lifeguard tower that even in this expression makes a difference. Visibility makes a difference. So we love that this group is stepping up and saying, please don't erase us in this way. Right? So that is a change.org petition that you can find. We don't have time really for more stories, but I will just say there's a new study out that says it will cost the U.S. military 114 times more to ban transgender soldiers than to keep them. It will cost the U.S. military 114 times more to ban transgender soldiers than to keep them. And another report, and obviously this is horrible, and you guys have to get out there and do your research. There's a report that shows that more LGBT people were killed so far in 2017 than in all of 2016. This is all to say there is so much work to do, everybody. There is so much work to do, and we have to do it together. We have to do ally building. That's what makes a difference. Nobody has ever said that LGBTQ people represent a majority of this population. They don't. And so we need allies. So I urge you every single week for 8-9 years now, you have to get out there. You have to use your voice the way you know how to use it to make a difference. Whether you are saving the Rainbow Lifeguard Tower, whether you are Maren Johns, the editor-in-chief of Curve Magazine, and thanks to her for her incredible work, whatever it is that you do to make a difference, get out there and use your voice and go do it. And while you're out there using your voice, while you're out there making a difference, please remember, why be gay when you can be so gay?
Judge us simply cause our hair is long. Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Pick it flat and pick it sight. Don't punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can't see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on. Ooh. Right on.